Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format, CQ Magazine for the month of August 2009. CQ Magazine is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Hand Him System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Him members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hymns may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyhim@courage.org. Our website, www.handyhim.org. We'll begin today in ham radio news. NASA, the sunspot cycle is not broken. A pair of jet streams some 4,000 miles below the surface of the sun may be responsible for the slow beginning of solar cycle 24, according to two researchers from the National Solar Observatory in Tucson, Arizona, whose remarks were reported by NASA. Speaking to reporters at the meeting of the National Astronomical Society in Boulder, Colorado in mid-June, researchers Rachel Howe and Frank Hill reported that the jet streams start near the sun's poles every 11 years and slowly migrate toward the equator. When those jet streams approach 22 degrees latitude, they said, new cycle sunspots begin to appear. Using a technique called helioseismology, Howe and Hill have been able to track the progress of these jet streams and said they're currently moving more slowly than usual, taking 3 years to cover a 10-degree range that is typically covered in two. The good news? Howe and Hill report that the jet streams are finally reaching the critical 22-degree latitude and that new groups of sunspots are beginning to emerge. NASA's Dr. Tony Phillips wrote that the research dispels concerns of a prolonged solar minimum, adding, the sun's internal magnetic dynamo is still operating and the sunspot cycle is not broken. CQ Propagation Editor Thomas Hunt and W7US, in an online commentary on the CQ website, had challenged May's report from solar experts, suggesting that we were heading into a short, weak cycle. Quoting, no one can postulate with any credibility just how intense the new cycle will be, because there's no direct correlation between this solar minimum and any regular pattern of past minimums, Hood wrote. Well, there's been another change at the FCC. McDowell renominated to FCC. President Obama announced in early June that he would nominate FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell to a full 5-year term on the commission. McDowell, a Republican, was originally appointed by President George W. Bush to complete the unexpired term of Commissioner Kathleen Abernathy, which ran through June 30th of this year. McDowell was sworn in on June 1, 2006. A communications attorney, McDowell served as a senior executive in the telecommunications trade group and a legislative aide to a Virginia state legislator before being named to the FCC. The White House statement highlighted McDowell's experience in creating rules governing wireless auctions, establishing a framework for unlicensed use of TV white spaces, and developing incentives to encourage new broadcast technologies. McDowell's nomination is subject to Senate confirmation. Well, we have a bit here about the Weather Service also. Weather Service predicts near normal hurricane season. The National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center's initial outlook for the 2009 hurricane season, which began June 1, is that it will more than likely be near normal, or not. According to the CPC, there is a 50% chance of a near-normal season, meaning 9 to 14 named storms, of which 4 to 7 could become hurricanes, and 1 to 3 might become major hurricanes. But there's also a 50% chance, say evenly split, that there will be a below-normal or above-normal season. Sounds like double talk to me, folks. I don't know about you. Had to look at that three times. Regardless of the seasonal outlook, said lead forecaster Jerry Bell, people in areas often threatened by hurricanes should prepare for the worst. It takes only one land-falling storm to make it a bad season, he noted. According to Commerce Secretary Gary Locke, whose department includes the National Weather Service and the National Hurricane Center, more than 35 million Americans live in regions most threatened by Atlantic hurricanes. I'll have more about the hurricane season later on in this broadcast, folks. Well, we go back to the FCC now, Federal Communications Commission, getting tough with power company. Nearly 3 years after first contacting Duke Energy about interference complaints from a ham in Cincinnati, the FCC is starting to lose patience with the facility. In a May 4 letter to the company, Special Counsel Laura Smith recounted the exchanges of correspondence and promises of action, but pointed out that the problems persist. She even noted that the complainant had gone out on his own and noted the specific locations of several possible noise sources. Quoting here, "Given the fact that this case has been ongoing for quite some time without resolution," Smith wrote, "you are directed to respond to the undersigned within 30 days, detailing what steps you have taken to resolve the interference," close quote. In addition, she told the company that if the problems persist for more than 60 days, quoting again, "Duke Energy will be required to provide the FCC with a status update every 2 weeks going forward as to what progress, if any, has been made to resolve the matter," close quote. Here's an announcement about satellite transponders. Call WB4APR proposes new HF to HF satellite transponder. The father of APRS, Bob Bruninger, WB4APR, is proposing a new combination of ham bands for satellite transponders. According to Newsline, Bruninger is looking for design help in developing a transponder that would operate on single sideband with an uplink on 29 MHz and a downlink on 24 MHz. He is interested in integrating that into a satellite design that would also include APRS, that's Automatic Packet Reporting Systems, on 2 meters as well as a 2-meter FM downlink for the single sideband voice signals transmitted up to the bird on 29 megahertz. A Belgian ham slated to be space station commander. Frank De Huyn, Oscar November 1, Delta Whiskey November, ON1 DWN, reportedly has been named commander of the International Space Station's Expedition 21 crew. The first European Space Agency astronaut to be given the status. All commanders so far have been either Americans or Russians. According to the MSAT news service, De Huyn was scheduled to be launched from Kazakhstan in late May to become part of the Expedition 20 crew and would become commander with the next crew rotation before heading home to Earth in November. As I look at Zero Bias, which is actually the title of a CQ editorial by Rich Mawson, W2VU, it's actually an apology to one of the representatives in Congress. Whoops, we misidentified the prime sponsor of House Bill H.R. 2160 in last month's Zero Bias editorial. Her correct name is Representative Sheila Jackson-Lee. Not surely. Our apologies to the Congresswoman also. In the first sentence of that editorial, we listed the bill number as H.R. 1216012160. The correct number is 2160, shown correctly in all other references. We regret any confusion. Well, here's a little bit of information about special event stations during the month of August into September. You know, before I give you that, I must make a comment, folks. This is the August 2009 issue of CQ Magazine. For whatever reason the publisher chooses, it seems that CQ magazine always gets to our mailboxes sometime very close to the beginning or after the first of a given month. And that sort of throws me off recording this material for different ham radio organizations for the sight-impaired or print-impaired individuals involved and listening to it, because a lot of the stuff that's printed in it actually goes into effect the very first or second day of that particular month. So therefore, some of the really interesting, for instance, in this case, special event stations, you're not going to hear about. Because today is already August the 5th. You won't get this before August 7th, 8th, 9th, or maybe even 10th, as far as the websites are concerned or the air broadcasts of them. So in reality, I think I'll just go with those specials that are sometime after the middle or around the middle of the month of August in this case. The first special call is WA3KEY Slant 2 from the 16th Annual Reunion of Aircraft Carrier USS Intrepid Association of Former Crew Members. It's from the flight deck of the Intrepid, which was CVS-11 in the Hudson River, New York. It's on August 14th to August 15th from various frequencies. Our next one, Whiskey 3 Oscar, W3O, from commemoration of the sesquicentennial of oil, Drake Well, near Titusville, New Pennsylvania, Fort Venango, Mike and Key, ARC. That'll be August 28th for 12 hours. K4 Alpha India, Kilo 4 Alpha India, from 75th Annual APCO Conference and Exposition, Las Vegas, Nevada, APCO International Amateurs. That's August 16 through 19 on single sideband various frequencies. The K5R, Kilo 5 Romeo, from commemoration of anniversaries of Hurricane Katrina and Rita, Hammond, Louisiana, Southeast Louisiana Amateur Radio Club, August the 29th. I'll give you one more here. It's a WHCYE, Whiskey 8 Charlie, Yankee Echo, from the celebration of 66 years of R. L. Drake Communications Excellence, Miamisburg, Ohio. That's the R. L. Drake ARC. That one is August 27th, various frequencies. And August being a nice month, usually fairly warm and clear, unless a hurricane comes to knock you over, here's a couple of August Hamfests. August 16th, the Denver Radio Club Hamfest, Jefferson County Fairgrounds, Golden, Colorado. August 21 through 23, Porter County ARC Swap Meet and Campout, All State Radio Club, W9SAL Complex, La Pointe, Indiana. August 22nd, Owen-Monroe Hamfest, Owen County Fairgrounds, Spencer, Indiana. And August 23rd, East Central Illinois Hamfest, Vermilion County Fairgrounds, Danville, Illinois. Enjoy. Get out of the house, drive around if it isn't too far to go, and get yourself warmed up a little bit walking around looking at some great amateur radio gear and talking with some really fine individuals in amateur radio. Next is some commentary from CQ Magazine Publications. It says, attention former World Radio subscribers. There still seems to be a fair amount of confusion among former World Radio subscribers about the status of that magazine and how to find and read current issues. In case you're one of those people, here is a rundown of the basics. World Radio is still being published online only, as World Radio Online. A new edition is posted online every month on or about the 20th of the month. Issues are currently free, with no subscription required. Virtually all World Radio columnists, including the crusty one himself, Kurt Den Sterba, continue to write their columns, and they continue to appear in World Radio Online, but not in CQ. Unless you give us other instructions, all World Radio subscriptions were converted to CQ subscriptions of varying lengths, depending on the length and type of your World Radio subscription. If you were already a CQ subscriber, any additional issues were added to your CQ subscription. Several options were available for World Radio Life subscribers, and these were mailed to them early on. If you are uncertain of what became of your World Radio subscription, please contact our circulation department by phone at the following number, area 516-681-2922, or by email at circulation@cq-amateur-radio.com. World Radio Online is not delivered by email. You must go to the CQ website and download each issue. I'll give you some instructions below. There is a World Radio Online email alert list to which you may subscribe at no cost, but this is for email alerts only and is not a subscription to the magazine, nor will it result in having the magazine email to you. If you sign up for this list, you will receive monthly alerts when each new issue is posted, as well as occasional other messages. When you sign up for the list, you will be given the option of receiving your messages in a daily digest form rather than individually. Please do not check this option. We are having trouble with it, and you may not receive messages properly. Generally speaking, members of this list will receive no more than one or two emails a month. You may not send a message to this list. Questions regarding the list should be sent to worldradio-i-owner@mailman.sunserver.com. We have more information on signing up for this list below. Now, with regard to finding World Radio Online, to access the current issue of World Radio Online, as well as past online issues, downloading tips, and other information, you will need to go to the WRO Welcome page on the CQ Magazine website. Here's how to do it. 1. Go to the CQ homepage at www.cq-amateur-radio.com. 2. Find the World Radio Online logo to the left of the CQ Magazine covers. Click on it. This will take you to the WRO Welcome page. At this point, you have several options. There are links to a variety of informational pages. We recommend that you read the viewing and downloading tips before doing anything else. The back issues link will take you to previous issues beginning February 2009 to download and view. There are several options for downloading and viewing the magazine. On the welcome page, you will see both the cover and the table of contents of the current issue. Clicking on the cover will download the complete issue. There are two options on how to do this, covered in the tips. It is the recommended route if you have a high-speed internet connection such as cable, DSL, or Fios. If you have a slower dial-up connection, clicking on the table of contents will let you download the issue in smaller segments. Again, see the downloading tips for different options. Currently, we are recommending that you do not use Mozilla Firefox when downloading World Radio Online. We have received several reports of Firefox freezing up when trying to download an issue. Microsoft Internet Explorer and Apple Safari appear to work just fine. Now, regarding this email alert list I mentioned, to sign up for the email alert list on which you will be notified when each new issue is posted, go to http://mailman.sunserver.com/mailman/listinfo, that's one word, listinfo, /worldradio-l. You will find a form there to use for signing up for or subscribing to this list. One of the questions you'll be asked is, would you like to receive list mail batches in a daily digest? The default for this is no. Again, please do not click yes. The digest program is not behaving properly, and you may not receive messages promptly or properly. If you are already signed up with the digest selected, you may go to the page above and unsubscribe. Then resubscribe without checking off the digest option, or send a note to the list administrator asking him to uncheck the digest option for your account. Be sure to include the email address under which you are signed up. We hope this will help clarify some confusing items and help you find, read, and enjoy each new issue of World Radio Online, just as we hope you are reading and enjoying each new issue of CQ. Sign 73, The Editors. I have an interesting public service piece. It's being offered by Richard Fisher, called KI6SN, Kilo India 6, Sierra November. It's headlined Sunset for Navy Mars, Spectre of shutting down mission raises questions and speculation. A dispatch announcing the possible shutdown of the Navy Marine Corps component of the military affiliate radio system sent a shudder through Mars operations in mid-May. The message was sent to all members from Navy Marine Corps Mars Chief Bo G. Lindford and NN0ASA, reading in part, this is a quotation, "Commander, Naval Network Warfare Command has decided to sunset, S-U-N-S-E-T, in quotations, the Mars mission within Navy as of September 30, 2009. And NWC has requested all military billets be deleted and defunded after that date. OPNAV, that's Office of the Chief of Naval Operations, has not yet approved this request." End quotation. The announcement prompted speculation and questions on internet message boards and in chat rooms about the future of Navy Mars. Lindford explained in his message that the decision was based on proposed updates in the 1998 Defense Department Directive, under which all three Mars programs, they are Navy, Marine Corps, Army, and Air Force, currently operate. These proposals, according to Lindford, put additional demands on the service branches themselves to support their Mars programs. Quoting again, "Army and Air Force have agreed to changes, but Navy, OPNAV, has to be let out of this requirement," end quotation, says Lindford's, adding, "This negotiation is still in process and we do not know when it will be resolved." Nonetheless, Lindford's continued, "I am forced to initiate action to close down Navy Marine Corps operations and facilities by 30 September 2009. He added that if the decision is ultimately reversed, quoting again, "there will be a Navy Marine Corps Mars program, but it will not have area directors. They will have been transferred. In that case," he said, "all membership correspondence will be handled directly between state directors and his office, and all operational matters will be handled by state and regional directors." Lindford's promised to keep members posted on the final resolution of the Navy's request to sunset Navy Marine Corps Mars, and we will keep you updated as the story develops. I'm going now to the category of World of Ideas. The contributing author here is David Ingram, K4TWJ, Kilo 4, Tango Whiskey Juliet. It's about lighthouses. Lighthouses brighten the airwaves, but fog is rolling in. Having noticed the increasing amount of on-the-air activity from lighthouses and lightships during recent times, there is a viable reason. Jim Wiedner, called K2JXW, founder of the Amateur Radio Lighthouse Society, and friends have diligently been promoting lighthouse activity since 1996. Plus, a second group based in Scotland has been promoting ham radio lighthouse operations on a worldwide basis even longer. They both have events scheduled for this month, and what used to be two distinct activities on two separate weekends are now overlapping, with the growing possibility of confusion for the average ham. We have no intention of taking sides here, except with you, the reader, who enjoys having fun on the air. So this month we're going to try to clear the air and shine some light on who is running what, when. The ARLHS has expanded its long-running National Lighthouse Lightship Weekend, traditionally the first weekend in August, into an International Lighthouse Lightship QSO party and special event operation between August 1 and August 9, covering the first two weekends of the month. Plus, the European group has its annual International Lighthouse Lent Lightship Weekend scheduled for August 15 and 16, the third weekend. As I will explain later, joining on-the-air activities, QSO parties, or contacting special event stations operating from the lighthouse grounds also earns credit for a variety of awards and certificates. First, however, let's discuss the unique roles of lighthouses and lightships themselves. Here's a lighthouse history brief. A brief study of lighthouses reveals they are nautical navigational aids typically used to mark hazardous shorelines, reefs, and entrances to harbors. They often are built round to withstand harsh, stormy weather and to minimize wind resistance, and many are painted with unique bands, spirals, and square or diamond patterns for easy recognition. Lighthouses have been in existence for several thousand years. They are included in various marine charts, and many have been maintained in remarkably good condition. Lighthouses are also historically significant landmarks, and a fair number are well-recognized tourist attractions, complete with park areas, mini-museums, and gift shops. A lighthouse has a glass-enclosed lamp room that during early times was equipped with a large oil lamp rotated by a gravity-fed pulley or gear system. An adjoining building was used for storage supplies, spare parts, food, etc. A live-in lighthouse keeper added oil to the lantern and rewound the pulley every few hours to ensure continuous operation of the lamp. Today, lighthouses are equipped with high-intensity electric lamps focused into a bright and long-range beam by a Fresnel lens. As a quick reference here, a somewhat similar Fresnel lens is used in an overhead projector to amplify light and throw images onto a screen in a meeting room or auditorium. Many lighthouses have their own power generators for emergency or standby operation, and some also include radar beacons with transponders that appear on a ship's radar screen, plus transmit their ID slant QTH in Morse code. Now let's take a good look at lightships. Lightships were akin to floating lighthouses, and I say were, because the last ones in service were retired or decommissioned in 1985. A lightship has a light and Fresnel lens type assembly mounted atop a tall mast or tripod, a foghorn or large bell, and a radio beacon, all for making its presence known during good and bad weather alike. Lightships were usually permanently anchored with a massive anchor to hold them firmly in place during storms. The ship's hull was very often marked with the name of its assigned location or post. The ships were used in waters too deep or otherwise unsuitable for supporting a conventional lighthouse. A number of lightships were lost in hurricanes and replaced by automated oil derrick-type light towers, or light buoys, with the high-intensity blinking lights like those utilized near airports and atop tall radio TV towers. They lacked the class, flash, and glamour of lightships. But that is the harsh reality of progress. Ah, well. The lightships surviving today have been refurbished and are enjoying life as tourist attractions and museums. Why have I included details of lighthouses and lightships in this month's column? Because they are historical landmarks, and also many radio amateurs are or have been associated with ships or some form of ship-to-shore communications, and many people enjoy investigating lighthouses. And lightships, I suppose. They are intriguing. Agreed? Now, the Amateur Radio Lighthouse Society was founded by Jim Wiedner, K2JXW, in 1996 and has grown to over 1,600 members worldwide today. Its purpose or mission is to promote awareness of the role amateur radio and lighthouses play in assisting and assuring safety at sea. It is also dedicated to preserving the heritage, history, and continuing existence of lighthouses and lightships, plus fostering friendship among radio amateurs worldwide. The Society offers a variety of impressive-looking certificates for confirming QSOAPs with stations operating from lighthouse-related sites in U.S. call areas, all 31 states with lighthouses, all continents, 25 countries, and more. The full story here is quite extensive and easily overflows available column space. Now, as regards to over there in Scotland across the Atlantic, over in Scotland, the AIR, A-Y-R, amateur radio group has been sponsoring the International Lighthouse Slant Lightship Weekend on the third weekend in August, since beginning as the Regional Northern Lighthouse Activity Weekend in 1995. This weekend coincides with International Lighthouse Day, the third Sunday in August, established by the International Association of Lighthouse Keepers. The ARLHS events in the United States initially were scheduled to match up with the congressionally created National Lighthouse Weekend on the first weekend in August. Apparently, there had been some discussion early on about merging the two events, but neither group wanted to abandon its chosen weekend. So they agreed to disagree and ran separate events, leading to some confusion among hams as to which was which and when. In conclusion, we hope that the two lighthouse groups will work things out in a friendly manner so that as many hams as possible can enjoy these activities, whether they are setting up stations at or near lighthouses or trying to work them. Meanwhile, there's a potential bonanza of lighthouse lightship stations on the air this month. Whether you're listening on the first, second, or third weekend, or sometime in between, there should be plenty of lighthouse stations out there to be worked. Well, that just about overflows the available space for this month, and we trust you have found this discussion interesting and informative. We look forward to hearing and contacting you during the upcoming lighthouse activities. And it's signed 73 Dave, K4TWJ. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your reader, Bob, N1BLF. I got this magazine just yesterday, as I had said a few moments ago. It was already August the 4th. First thing that struck me is a very, very nice photograph of two individuals. They seem to glow with contentment. There's a lot of ham radio gear in the background at the workstation. So as I'm reading along, I come to information about the cover of the August 2009. Lynn and Rosie Lamb, L-A-M-B, of Maryville, Tennessee, are among the best-known DXing couples in ham radio today. Lynn, called W4NL, has been at the top of the honor roll since 1984, has DXCC on 9 bands, including 228 countries confirmed on 160 meters, worked all zones on 8 bands, including 36 zones on 160, and 328 countries confirmed on QRP at 10 watts. Rosie, his XYL, called KA4S, is just one confirmation away from top of the honor roll recognition herself. Both Lynn and Rosie, along with George Dominic, W4UWC, founded SEDCO, S-C-D-C-O, that's the Southeastern DX and Contesting Organization, 5 years ago, and its annual convention in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, has quickly become one of the major DX and contesting events of the year. Rosie and Lynn have been married 52 years and both are retired from the Department of Defense, where they worked as civilian employees. Rosie was an executive secretary and Lynn held various positions in Navy weapons programs, spending his last 3 years before retirement as weapons director for the entire Navy. He was awarded the Superior Civilian Service Award, that's the Navy's second highest civilian honor, for his work on weapons systems during Operation Desert Storm. Lynn's current ham radio activities include QRP, low power, CW, and digital modes, and he is now getting into 6-meter DXing as well. One of his favorite ham radio moments, though, was recently when he was talking on PSK-31 with his friend and digital mentor, Ted McDonald, called K7OM. Lynn says his grandson, Dawson, and Ted's granddaughter, Sarah, each took over their respective keyboards to talk to each other on the radio. That very bright and sparkly photograph was provided by Larry Mulvihill, WB2ZPI. I'm taking a look here at the awards column by Ted Malinowski, K1BV. It's headlined From Antarctic Ice to Silver Camels. Well, I may not get to the Silver Camels part, whatever that is, because of time constraints here, but I see something interesting. It goes this way. This time we start off with an award from Argentina. DXers know that whenever they hear an Argentine station with the first letter of the suffix starting with Z, for Zulu, that is a worthy DX. In Argentina, the first letter of the suffix identifies the province, and Z is one of the Antarctic bases located on largely uninhabited places, such as South Georgia, South Shetland, South Orkney, and South Sandwich Islands. The award is especially colorful, including a montage of rare QSLs from these countries. The award is the worked Argentine Antarctic bases. The WAAB award is sponsored by the radio club Rio de la Plata for confirming contacts since November 9, 2001 with stations located on at least 3 different Argentine Antarctic bases. If you're listening and you're a shortwave tuner inner, you don't have to be a ham either. All bands from 2 meters through 160 meters and modes, single sideband, CW Morse code, RTTY teletype, and digital count for the awards. Any newly established Argentine Antarctic base will be automatically added to the list and will be valid for this award. If you're interested in getting some wallpaper for this, send a GCR list of contacts with QSO details, including call sign and date, in alphabetical order by call sign, plus a photocopy of each of the cards. The sponsor reserves the right to request actual cards at its discretion. Include the fee of AUS $3, US $17, or 13 euros for large format certificates. Here's another award, Italy's Regio Insubrica Award. The following award is new, starting in 2009, and it's one of the first I've seen that specifically plans portable operations that count for several specialized awards in a similar nature. If you're hunting castles, churches, lakes, and mountain summits, one contact with Insubria Radio Club's mini expeditions may help you with 4 other awards. The award is issued in order to promote the beauty of the landscape, historical and artistic heritage, and rural culture of Euro region Regio Insubrica. That's R-E-G-I-O-I-N-S-U-B-R-I-C-A, Regio Insubrica, which includes Ticino, Switzerland, and the Italian provinces of Como, Lecco, Novara, Verbancuseo Ossola, and Varese. The goal is to contact stations HB9IRC and or IQ2IR on or after January 1, 2009 during this publicized portable activities, which concentrate on 1. Castles, towers, and defensive works, which may be counted for various castle awards in Italy and Switzerland. 2. Churches, abbeys, and monasteries, valid for the Italian Abbeys Award. And 3. Lakes, valid for the Italian Lakes Award and worked all Swiss lakes. And 4. Mountain summits, valid for summits on the Air Italia. So if you're a good SWL listener or amateur radio operator, you probably have to be pretty good to dig them out, I think, from the United States, but who's to say, huh? Good luck with that. Here's an interesting piece about a gentleman named Leo C. Bingham, B-I-N-G-H-A-M. His call is WY7LL, Whiskey Yankee 7 Lima Lima. It's regarding USA CA All Counties, number 1184, April 27, 2009. It goes, I became interested in radio at a very young age. I was in first or second grade. That was 1968, in a small oil field community named Lynch, Wyoming. My parents owned an interest in an oil field pipeline ditching and construction company there. My father ran the field operations while my mother ran the office, bookkeeping aspects of the company. One day, my father brought home a Johnson Messenger 223 base station for my mother's office, along with a couple of Johnson mobile radios for the trucks. Oh, how that base station caught my eye. The thought that you could push a button on that microphone and someone a world away could hear you. I was hooked from the start. I watched my father struggle for years trying to get more range by using bigger antennas and amplifiers with little return for his effort. Over the years, my folks always had two-way radios in their automobiles and homes. They became dependent on being able to communicate with them, as this was way before cell phones, and living in Wyoming at maybe 60 miles or better to the next town, gas station, or even ranch house. Through the years, I found that you could make long-distance contacts with those so-called chicken band radios, CB. By the time I was 16, I had worked my way through numerous radios and had graduated, or so I thought, to the big time. I had acquired a Tempo 1 ham radio that had a VFO and more power to make those elusive contacts. Finally, at the age of 26 in 1983, I met someone who would introduce me to ham radio. I joined the novice classes that were being given, learning theory and code with a new abandon. I took my novice test and received my ticket in the mailbox on April 9, 1984. Now I was really in the big leagues. I upgraded to technician about 6 months later into general on September 22, 1985. Best as I can recall, on November 10, 1985, I was tearing down the 20-meter band, making DS contacts left and right, tuning the VFO on the Yaesu FD-101EE and breaking pileups whenever I would tune into one. I tuned into a pileup on 14336 with calls being dumped in by the pound, so I put my call in, made my contact, and waited for the deck station's call. When it came back, KC3RY, on the county line of Sussex and Warren, New Jersey, I thought there had to be a mistake. So I listened for a time until I surmised that I had stumbled onto the county hunter's net. So off I went, searching for more DX stations. As time passed, I would return to 14336 when DX conditions were not good. Soon I was out running counties for some folks who had asked for special contacts that they needed to finish up for a particular award. My wife and I enjoyed the day trips and even some overnighters, and as time went on, whenever we were traveling, we made sure we had a radio to give out counties. In the 25 years, I have run every county in Wyoming, Montana, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and most of Nebraska. I had acquired a good number of counties just by giving out counties, but how many did I have? I spent weekends and evenings all of one winter typing contacts into a new computer logging program, as the paper logs had become a paper tiger. Now I had to go back over years of logs and send cards. Luckily, I did get back a large number of cards from operators who still had their logs even years later. Now to get serious about finishing up USACA. In January 2006, I was down to 350 counties. I decided it was time to meet some of the folks I had been working for years, and my wife and I set out for Appleton, Wisconsin in July. Without many people knowing, we were headed to the National County Hunters Convention while running a county in Minnesota. A station called and wanted to know where I was. After confirming my location, he said, "Look in your rearview mirror." Cliff, Alpha Charlie Zero Bravo, was only the second county hunter I had ever met face-to-face in my 22 years of county hunting, and he was going to the convention, too. When I arrived at the convention, I was shocked at the reception that this Wyoming cowboy received. Everyone treated us so well, like long-lost family, and within minutes, we had a dinner invitation for the evening. As the weekend progressed, I felt like I was right at home. It was great to put faces with names and calls. We attended the National in Denver in 2007 and the National in Michigan last year. Finally, in February 2009, I was down to four counties to work. One was in Montana, one in Idaho, and two in Georgia. We had planned a week of vacation in the middle of February to go to a law enforcement convention in Florida. At the last minute, our convention plans were canceled, so we were off to Montana and Idaho to get those confirmed from WY7ML on 2 meters. Then, to start working on Georgia contacts, I sent an email to a ham in Wheeler, Georgia, who agreed to a schedule. At 6.05 a.m. that Saturday, we made a 40-meter contact, and I was now down to one to go. I'd also made a schedule with Don, K3IMC, whom I had met at the two conventions I attended. Don was making a special trip to Upsom, Georgia, my very last. At 9:21 a.m., I was mobile and heard KM9X trying to get Don and myself together. We made our contact on 40-meter single sideband, although very weak copy. Then we iced it off by making a 5-9 contact on 20-meter single sideband and a 30-meter CW contact. After 25 years, I had finally made that last county contact. As I looked over to my wife in the passenger seat, she had trickles of tears she was trying to conceal behind her sunglasses. I think she was happier for me than I was for myself. I must admit I enjoy being the hunted more than hunter. We still enjoy putting out counties when we travel. We have met a fantastic group of people during our county hunting experiences. The list of people to thank is long and distinguished. My wife and driver, Chris, WY7ML, is at the very top of the list. She does the bulk of driving while I navigate and log on the computer, thanks to the NetControl volunteers and the operators who run mobile. Without those folks, none of us would ever finish USA, CA, all counties. You all know who you are, and I thank and salute you one and all. 73, Leo. Whiskey, Yankee 7, Lima, Lima. Leo C. Bingham. USA, CA, all counties, number 1184. April 27, 2009. Let's take a closer look at contesting by John Doerr, K1AR. He headlines this piece, "Has Contesting Reached Its Peak?" There are some cold, hard facts about our hobby and contesting in particular that we need to face. At this year's Dayton Hamvention, the continued aging of contests, with the notable exception of a few such as K0DXC, was even more apparent to most of us. That fact, combined with all the other factors we keep hearing about, for example, the internet, cell phones, computer games, etc., is dramatically impacting the availability of new radio hobbyists, young and old. Unlike the old days, when many of us became hams, worldwide access to people and information is incredibly affordable and available right at our fingertips. Ain't it the truth? Have you walked through a consumer electronics store lately? It's particularly interesting to look at the computer gaming section of a typical store. This may not surprise you, but it sure doesn't look like the contest super suite at the Dayton Hamvention. The average age of the customers is probably 15 years old, dominated by a group of youngsters who have at least as much enthusiasm for their sport as we did for our ham radio sport in our youth. There are some kids who have as many internet friends around the world as we know hams. Yes, my fellow contester, we have serious competition indeed. Well, now that I've got you to the point of wanting to sell your equipment while there's still a marginal market of buyers available, let's shift gears and focus on an attribute of contesting that's very curious, especially in light of my earlier comments. Why is that? In a period of seemingly stagnant and declining growth, we continue to see contest scores and participation escalating. With this escalation, have we in fact seen the peak of contesting? After all, we have established by most popular measures that the population of available HF contesters is declining. With the average age of hams rising, isn't the number of contest hours operated by a typical competitor less than ever before? It seems that we have all of the ingredients to witness a decline in overall scores, not an increase. That should translate into an overall decline in contest interest and perhaps the conclusion that we have seen the best days. However, all you need to do is flip on the radio in any reasonable-sized contest and your receiver will be filled with operators across the band. Whether it's the CW Worldwide, a 160-meter contest, or the ARRL sweepstakes, the bands are alive with the sounds of contesters, as Julie Andrews might have said had she been a ham. Well, I believe there are a number of factors to consider, beginning with continuing improvements in and accessibility to modern ham gear, especially overseas. Certainly, again, hurt scores now that more operators have better equipment to use when operating. Indeed, the days of Eastern Europeans using 16-tune UW3DI designs largely are over. The result? Higher scores. And with higher scores comes increased interest in contest operating by everyone. Another aspect of this discussion has to do with the number of available stations to work. Now, this may seem contradictory to my opening comments, but while amateur radio growth is declining, there are pockets of seemingly dramatic increases. You can determine this in many ways, but an obvious one is to think about a country's newly issued call signs. Consider what's happening in countries such as England, with the M block now nearly fully subscribed, or Germany. Yes, there is a horde of new call signs out there. There are plenty of other examples around the world. To be fair, some of this call sign jockeying is a result of local vanity programs, but there's no denying that many countries are seeing an influx of new HF operators. For those competitors who benefit most from the availability of Europeans, these new fellows are a boon to contest scores. Also, when combined with other geographic hotspots, the picture may not be as bleak as we think. It's apparent that the quality of operating is growing, too. There once was a day when I was concerned about setting my key or speed too high. Would I miss out on stations calling me because I was sending too fast? Now, admittedly, coming from an East Coast perspective, we can't send fast enough to at peak rate times during a DX contest. The volume of quality operators has markedly increased for sustainable periods. This translates into higher rates and higher scores. In fact, it's become a disappointment in my part of the world if your peak rates on CW are less than 150 per hour during CQ Worldwide DX contesting. I would add that this is not just a CW issue. Single sideband rates have climbed to staggering levels as well. The fact is that there are just more stations to work on any mode, in any contest, at any time of the year. I would add that this is true for both DX and domestic contests. Take a look at the ARRL sweepstakes results if you doubt the claim. As another example, the recently held 2009 CQWPX contests have received a record number of logs. That's good for us and great for the hobby in general. So, what can be concluded here? As active participants in our hobby, we certainly have cause for concern about its future. Yet there's ways to measure activity and interest, and fortunately one of them is contest operating. Contesting has a lot of gusto and momentum. It's always been an aspect of amateur radio that many hams have enjoyed for a variety of reasons. Why? Because it's not hard and addresses interests of many hams, whether their focus is on DXing, station performance, or just wanting to make an interesting QSO. As contesting reaches peak, I don't think so. We may be in for a tough stretch as poor conditions continue. But I remain cautiously optimistic that we'll be back for another day. So don't miss out by folding up your contest tent. You'll regret the fact that you did. It's always a privilege to acknowledge new inductees into CQ's Contest Hall of Fame, and this year is no exception. Paul Bittner, B-I-T-T-N-E-R, Paul's call is W-0-A-I-H, Whiskey Zero Alpha India Hotel, is the 2009 inductee, and deservedly so. As someone who has known Paul for a very long time, I can attest to his contributions both as an operator, station builder, as well as a mentor to so many others. I would guess that Paul has lost count of the number of contest operators, new and experienced, who have enjoyed his hospitality and that of his ex-wife, Mary, all from the surprising and propagationally hostile location of Western Wisconsin. Congratulations, Paul. You are a first-class contester and an even better person. Well, that's all for this month. I hope enjoy reading the CQ WWDX single sideband results in this month's copy of CQ. That's August 2009. As always, there was a lot of sweat equity that went into producing the final results. With that being said, the 2009 fall contest season is nearly upon us. I hope to see you in my log. See you in the next contest. 73, John, K1AR. Folks, that just about brings me up to time for this month's reading of CQ Magazine for August 2009 here on the Courage Handyham system. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. My name is Bob Zeta. I spell as Z-E-I-D-A. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. My QTH, our geographic location is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. If you'd like to comment to me directly or to the Courage Handyhams, you can send email to me at my call sign, n1blf@comcast.net. I'd love to hear from you for any constructive comments or criticism, and I thank you for your time again today. 7388 and 1BLF.